You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Christine Buckley, and this is Field Talk, a podcast produced by the Ecological Society of America. In Field Talk, we talk with authors whose papers have been published in three of the Society's journals, Ecology, Ecological Applications, and Ecological Monographs. Today I'm speaking with Jameel Samhouri, a fisheries biologist who works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. In his study in the April issue of Ecology, Dr. Samhouri and his colleagues examine the effects of density and competition with populations of a small reef fish. He found that natural selection on young fish doesn't just depend on having suitable habitat, but also on the presence of adult fish in their population. Dr. Samhouri, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So my first comment is something you must get all the time. You spend your time studying reef fish in the Bahamas. It must be a tough life for you.
Yeah, it's absolutely awful. No, it's quite fun, and I appreciate it all the more now that I spend my time working in Puget Sound, Washington, which is roughly 40 degrees colder in the water, and it turns out that there are things like currents and wind and waves to deal with here.
So aside from their great location, how did you choose these reef fish, well, these gobies, as your study organism?
Well, we were interested in the extent to which refuges from predators mediated interactions between adult and juvenile reef fishes, and whether or not interactions between adults and juveniles affected patterns of natural selection. And so goldspot gobies were a good study organism for investigating these questions for a few reasons. First of all, the adults and juveniles live in the same habitat and interact with one another. So the ecological interaction exists. The juvenile gobies use refuges from predators immediately upon settling to the reef out of the plankton. So they're smart. They decide to hide from predators when they're attacked. And the practical part is they are easy to catch, count, and move around. So they're a good experimental organism.
You mentioned that they have this planktonic life cycle where the juveniles will settle in the same area where the adults are living. Is this uncommon in fishes or in reef fishes that there might be one life history stage that lives in a different place than the next life history stage?
No, actually, it's quite common. Most reef fishes have this complex life cycle. It's sort of like frogs and tadpoles or caterpillars and butterflies in the sense that you have two stages of the life cycle that occur in two different habitats. With reef fish, their eggs hatch, and those larvae then enter the plankton where they live offshore for some period of time that may last from anywhere from 10 days to several months or a year, depending on the species. When they have developed sufficiently, they then settle out of plankton onto a reef and then begin life in the reef-based stage, turning into metamorphosing into something that we're used to seeing when we're diving.
It seems as though the adult fishes would probably be better competitors and therefore better able to establish territories. So did juveniles even get to have their own territories?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the juveniles are so busy worrying about getting eaten. I mean, literally, these things are the size of your pinky fingernail at most. So they're really quite small.
Wow.
You wouldn't even notice them unless you waved your hand across the sand on a reef often, unless you knew what to look for. So they're not so much worried about establishing a territory, it's just making it to live another day. So in some ways, they're not bothering to establish a territory, but they do need places to hide so they're not gobbled up by predators. In some senses, the larger, older fish exclude them from refuges, but they can also fit into smaller holes in the reef than the larger fish. So there's some subset of refuges that are not available to the adults that are available to the juvenile.
But how big is an average adult goby?
Probably the largest adult goby you would see would be about the size of your entire pinky finger for this particular species.
Your study focuses on population dynamics. Can you explain what that is and why it's important for ecologists to study it?
Sure. Population dynamics is just a fancy way of saying how we study the way a population grows and shrinks through time. It's basically demography, where you're tracking births, deaths, immigration, and emigration. And this field is important because studying how and why the number of individuals in a population changes through time helps us to explain what causes a variation in the distribution and abundance of a species, which is a sort of central goal in ecology.
And it sounds like it has pretty big implications for the evolution of a species too, right?
Yeah, it sure can, especially if those demographic rates are related to particular traits of individuals like body size or some metric of swim performance in the case of fish, things like that.
Right. Can you walk us through your experimental design where you manipulated different reefs to look at these population dynamics?
Sure thing. Yeah, this was a cool experiment. It's fun in hindsight, but it was quite challenging at the time we were doing it. We wanted to test two different hypotheses. First, that crowding by adult gobies reduces juvenile goby growth and survival. And second, that a juvenile goby's probability of surviving is related to traits it acquired during that larval stage in the plankton and is influenced by conditions that those newly settled juveniles face once they reach the reef. The two main experimental treatments in our study were going to be goby density and refuge availability. We worked at five study sites that varied naturally in goby density. So that gave us one of our experimental treatments. And goby density varied from much less than one goby every 10 square meters at some sites to more than five in every square meter. So it's a pretty large range of variation. And then the main manipulation we did was with refuge availability, so that we either have a low refuge treatment or a high refuge treatment. So this is where the challenge came in, because what we did is we had to go around to keys surrounding the study reefs and collect limestone rocks and conch shells that had washed up on shore, load the boat without sinking it, and then transport those rocks over to the study sites and huck them overboard without falling in ourselves. Once they were overboard, we tried to do this just on one side of each reef. So the reef was divided in half. We'd send divers down and we'd go and redistribute the rocks so that they were relatively uniformly distributed across half of each of the study sites. So that gave us sort of an ambient low shelter treatment and then a high shelter treatment.
Were you one of these divers who went down and redistributed rocks?
Yeah, I was fortunate or unfortunate, depending how you look at it, of participating in the entire process from collecting the rocks on shore to diving down to redistribute the rocks, which involved bringing two buckets per diver and kind of doing the moonwalk, because you can't really swim when you're carrying 2 5-gallon buckets of rocks around the reef. So you just very carefully tiptoe around corals on sand and try to move the rocks around.
You assumed that the addition of these rocks to your study plots would decrease the amount of juvenile mortality. Is that what you found?
Yeah, so that was an interesting, and honestly, it was a bit surprising that it worked out this way. But what we found was that on the half of each of our study sites where we didn't add rocks, increasing adult goby densities led to decreasing juvenile survival, and it was a pretty steep relationship. In contrast, where we added rocks, there was almost no relationship between adult density and juvenile survival, suggesting that adult crowding of juveniles or competition was much less important when refuges were abundant.
So how did you get started studying reef fish?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, I participated in a study abroad program in Panama, and one of the courses taught by Steve Bacala and Stuart Sandon focused on coral reefs in Bocas del Toro on the Caribbean coast. So once I figured out that I could have a job where the only suit I would ever be required to wear would be a wetsuit, I was sold. So I went on to do my undergraduate thesis research studying reef fish diversity and reef architecture in Curaçao in the Caribbean, and then on to graduate school.
So what do you think is the most exciting part of your job now? You work at NOAA, and this must be very different from working in the Bahamas where you did your field work for your dissertation.
Yeah, it is really different in some ways. There are two main parts to my current job. One is similar to what I was doing in the Bahamas, which is I still do field work. Now I do it in Puget Sound. And so the most exciting part about that is the same as it was in the Bahamas, which is that first time you tip yourself off the boat and open your eyes underwater and see what's going on, because there's always something new, a new big predator that's around, or a new settlement event of small little reef fishes have shown up, or a big storm has come through, and so a bunch of the kelp has disappeared, something like that. So there's always a chance that you're going to discover something new for yourself, or maybe even in terms of research. The other part of my job at NOAA involves using models to try to figure out what the best ecosystem indicators are. So what are the vital signs we should be tracking to determine ecosystem health? And what's cool and exciting about that is that there's a captive audience. There are actually management bodies that are interested here to use scientific input to determine management actions. And so there's I derive a fair amount of satisfaction from knowing that the science I'm doing can be applied in the short term.
Probably can't wear board shorts when you're presenting results to higher-ups at NOAA anymore.
I don't think that would be appropriate all the time, but you'd be surprised.
Jamil Semhori, thanks a whole lot.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was Jamil Semhori, a fisheries biologist who works for NOAA at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. I'm Christine Buckley. Thanks for listening to Field Talk.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.